Thank you. Come by, Gloria. Come by. I'm sorry. I'm sorry that, I'm sorry for everything, really. Sorry for the state of the world.
Okay.
No.
The girl with the pink dress. It's almost 5 o'clock on a warm spring evening in Yambio, a state capital in the west of South Sudan, where I've been meeting and interviewing girls recently released by rebels from the jungle, where they'd been taken against their will to work as domestic servants, informal wives, spies, and foragers and looters. Each tale has been different, but each one has featured a harrowing list of crimes, both against the girls themselves and against the local population. South Sudan gained independence in 2011 after almost 30 years of conflict against her northern rulers, the Sudanese, but collapsed into civil war in 2013 as a result of internal politics turned violent. In the West, when two political figures fall out, we discuss and debate on television. Here it resulted in arms being taken up, and girls like Gloria being abducted from villages, from schools, from their families, sometimes with their families, to serve the armed forces. The recent ceasefire at the end of 2017 has given a measure of hope, cautious and fragile, that the country can start building towards a more stable and prosperous future. As part of this, children and young adults who were co-opted by the rebels into taking up arms or serving those who did are being formally rehabilitated and reintegrated into their communities. And that is why I'm apologising to one of the girls, a 17-year-old called Gloria, who has just asked me if there's any chance of our providing a plastic sheet for the simple hut that she's likely to soon call home.
Like still raising another concern. So maybe if there's any possibility for her to get at least a plastic sheet.
The hut having been damaged recently in a storm. A humble ambition, a sheet to keep the rain off her head before she can even consider the future. How can you begin to articulate the state of lives here in South Sudan? One of the girls told me that she had witnessed a soldier having his heart cut out and being eaten by the rebels.
One police officer was arrested and taken to the bush. And this police officer was slaughtered. And then they removed his heart and cooked it. Yeah, this armed group cooked it live and she saw it.
I heard many times of drugs being used to numb the minds of the girls to the consequences and meaning of acts they were forced to perpetrate against local communities. A feature of the cruelty that occurred in the jungle was the forcing of young people to witness and at times participate in barbaric acts, to conscript their minds to the law of violence.
This armed group, they used to rape girls. Okay, even the girls who are within, who are among them, they used to rape them.
It can be very easy to normalize, become numb oneself to the language they use to describe the violence in their lives, to become a little blasé when the words rape, murder, and torture are used in every interview. But consider what these words mean. Consider the impact the acts must have on young impressionable minds. To see life ended, to feel a part of this horrific act at such a young age. One of the girls saw her brother forced to murder someone. Another described how the rebels would slaughter prisoners without bullets to save ammunition. They talk about beatings for insubordination. One girl suggested her father was killed for objecting to their presence there. He's not been seen since they arrived in the jungle. Throughout the day, the staff organise activities: volleyball, dancing, group games, high energy, positive, fun. The girls display a competitiveness, a fieriness, a joy in such moments, which can lull you into a complacency about their states of mind. One minute you watch a girl celebrating a volleyball point or dancing freely with her friends. The next, she's quietly telling you about her life in the jungle, nervously fiddling with her hands or a ball of polyester yarn they use to practice sewing. The scene moves between happy youth group and counselling session rapidly. Hope for the future, the memories of the past, mingle together now in my memory. And again, the complacency sets in. I have to force myself to imagine the lives they led just months ago in the jungle, whilst I watched them play or dance. Months ago, by their own accounts, they lived in fear and suffering, unable to express any basic positive human emotion. Every time I've asked, gently, if there was anything positive about life with the rebels, wondering if maybe they found redeeming comradeship in the hardship, the answer has been swift and brutal.
So, life for Nako in the bush was so horrible because it was not...
The moral complexity of their choices, the varying levels of complicity in the acts of war, does not pass me by. Some of the girls became wives to soldiers, even if informally. Many of them participated in looting, and most of them will experience suspicion and even hostility when they return home. Every conflict in history involves forced cooperation, the basic human instinct to survive. How many people have the recklessness to defy a gun or a knife in the face, in the darkness of conflicts far from watchful eyes? The moral taint and judgment of collaboration lingers in this traumatized society. Neighbors recall crimes committed by children who once ran freely through the fields.
This has created a big hatred between them and the neighbors.
The stain of participation and moral complicity is rarely borne by the commanders or leaders who sign the agreements and have the means to hide away afterwards, but by the ordinary girls and boys who are forced on threat of life to steal crops, to act as spies, to watch as prisoners were murdered before their eyes, sometimes to participate in those very same crimes. One of the striking features about the girls is their impatient desire to return to education. I'm accosted by several of them in the brief time I'm with them in the centre, a none so subtle demand for help with school registration and fees. Early on, I noticed one girl in particular who was forward and friendly, asking about life in America and when my charity's American head will visit again. I naturally assumed a degree of affection from her towards both him and vicariously myself, as if she were a simple 15-year-old batting her eyelids at exciting foreigners. But quickly I realised my mistake. This girl is not motivated by curiosity of the West, nor the glamour of white people. She has a practical, direct agenda. She wants to escape this land that has treated her so badly. This is no childlike innocence, but hard-nosed reality, a plea for life to give her a break.
Planning to go back and continue with her studies, but the only challenge is she doesn't have anyone to sponsor her.
When the fifth girl has approached me for support, I find my uttering of clichés and empty truisms demoralising to my own ear. Telling them it's difficult for me to fund a term's education for $50 is a lie, albeit a lie born out of a desperately difficult consideration. Where does one draw the line and how? To fund one can be to fund all. To fund one term can be to fund for life. Charity, I'm told repeatedly, must be sustainable. It must be about the long term and not a simple handout. But charity can also surely be about the short term too. And if we start by excluding anything that is not demonstrably long term, surely we can sign the most desperate and vulnerable to a fate resembling a slow death. The girls are soon to move out of the rehabilitation centre and back into their communities. I spoke to 10 girls and not a single one had the hope of returning to a house with a responsible male figure who could protect them. Because no matter what our perception of gender is in the West, in a patriarchal society like South Sudan, what matters most for teenagers is the presence of support from a father to fund education and to protect them from malign influences. One of the girls told me that if she's not accepted back by an elder sister, her only hope, she will live with anyone, anywhere in the community. I feel sickened by the implication in her words. Anyone.
But if the sister doesn't want to stay with her, she will go and live with anybody in the community.
But even when a girl has a clear idea of where to return, there's little hope of formal education for some of them, little spare cash, and most of them talk of vocational training. How swiftly my mind imagines a vocational course in a college, the hands-on training schemes in the West that we sometimes disdain. But here, vocational training could mean working for nothing in the community, at the mercy of forces beyond my understanding and imagination. Perhaps this works out. Perhaps they will become seamstresses and tailors. Yet somehow this feels fragile. To my surprise, two of the girls, they say they wish to become doctors. When someone says this in my country, I caution them to do some work experience, get an idea of what level of commitment it requires, perhaps offer help with an application form. Here, how can you even begin to plot a route from the jungle to the only medical school in the country, far away in the capital? I may as well draw them a map to the moon, it feels. The girls have formed a tight-knit circle, the atmosphere of sisterhood abounding. They wash each other's clothes, do each other's hair, dance together, occasionally fall out. I notice how comfortably and naturally they look after each other's children. The 10 or so children belonging to a group of 32 girls under the age of 18. I feel very male here, not unwelcome, but here according to their rules, on their terms, on their turf. And a little awed, a little intimidated by the atmosphere. I think and I hope that right now these girls would defend each other with their lives. But when they leave this safe space, an overused expression at home more likely to refer to intellectual freedom as physical, they re-enter a male world that will not see them as children needing space and time to mature, to rehabilitate into the adult world. This world will demand much of them, offer little, and exploit any weakness without hesitation. The world they return to will contain fewer games of volleyball and more hard labor, I imagine. I ask a few of them what their hopes are for the future. I ask a few of them what the challenges were living in the jungle. It feels like I'm interviewing them for a job, and I silently chastise myself. One of the hardest parts of the interviews is finding a shared language. I suspect my translator and guide is adept at turning my naive questions into something the girls can relate to. South Sudan has hope, the hope of youth. Can it build and nurture a generation of young people who feel invested in peace and prosperity? Can it find a way to create amicable debate and problem solving beyond the gun? My immediate challenge is to find a way to articulate the experience of young people who lost years of their life to conflict and violence without resorting to banal apologies and stereotypes. I asked one of the girls how she ended up in the bush. She answered for 6 minutes. My translator could only remember 1 minute of what she said. But I recorded it though, and now I owe it to her to get what she said translated. But what comes out of that interview, all these interviews, what emerges from the jungle in the hearts, minds and mouths of these young people will define this country for long after I have left. Several of the girls asked how they might be able to leave this country to find opportunity abroad. If we could take 32 girls who have known injustice and suffering beyond a lifetime for us out of this country and give them a fresh start, if we had the resources to, would we? For now, they are stuck here, and all we can do is hope that somehow they will get the support they need to develop into the adults of tomorrow who will believe in peace and reconciliation. I sleep fitfully. A mosquito has penetrated my net and my mind and now lurks like a troubling thought. I wake up and search for it. Eventually I find it and kill it. But the thought is not so easily dealt with. How can I arrive in these girls' lives with an expensive camera, a mission to accomplish, and then simply leave? I realize something. For these 2 months, there is something very special going on in their lives. For maybe the first time, they've been given space, time, and permission to express themselves as young adults. They have rested weary heads, formed friendships, known fun and freedom, and been shown a world without fear and violence. Yet when they leave, we may not be able to guarantee anything more than a plastic sheet over their heads. How can we risk returning them to a world of cruelty and violence? Can we really save them from the abyss and then toss them back again? Gloria is talking further about where she will live when she leaves the centre. She left the jungle with nothing, but received some clothes when she arrived at the centre, including the pink dress she's wearing now. She wonders what will happen to her possessions when she leaves, the fragile life she's trying to rebuild. It's this thought that makes me most upset. She looks lovely in the pink dress, like any 16-year-old around the world, growing into adulthood, finding her way, expressing herself. 2 months ago, she wore rags and lived in fear for her life. Now she's wearing a pink dress. But what about tomorrow? How can I leave them? How can we leave them? I want to cry. The luxury of emotion and imagination. Thank you, Gloria. I still want to apologise. I still don't know what I'm apologising for, really. The state of the world. Maybe it's that simple.